Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome back to the podcast that is always up to speed with Formula One. It is Sunday night, September, 24th, 25th, 26th?
26.
I don't know. 26. Oh my God, it's almost October. Where did the time go? Hey, Mark, you know, this is interesting. We've barely texted. We've barely even spoken all day long. But before we get into the show and talk about this race that happened this weekend at Sochi for the Russian Grand Prix, is it fair enough to say best Russian GP ever? Am I going too far, or is that par for the course? I don't think it's a stretch.
I think that's very, very fair. And I think based on some news that we learned earlier today that 2022 will be the last iteration of the Russian Grand Prix that we will ever see in Sochi, I think you can probably now chalk this up as the best Grand Prix we will ever see at Sochi. Because as we described during our last podcast, the race will move just northwest of St. Petersburg for 2023 at Agora Drive. So if you enjoyed Sochi today, make sure you tune in next year because that will be the last that we ever see of this track.
Well, you know, the thing is, if Bernie Ecclestone was still running Formula One, I'm sure he would have a kind of a special hotline into Russian senior leadership and like, you guys want rain? We'll get you rain, you know?
Yeah.
Anyways, joking aside, yeah, it really made for an interesting weekend. I mean, qualifying was something else. I mean, it really turned the grid upside down. And it was spectacular. I mean, the thing is, if you go back, and maybe I should just go over the race classification here before we do that. But I mean, the funny thing is that if you go and actually see like the final or like how it played out without actually watching the race or the race itself, you would be completely misled as to everything that went on Sunday afternoon, because you have Lewis Hamilton winning. I mean, congratulations to Lewis, first driver to 100 race wins in Formula One. That is a magnificent achievement in and of itself. Max Verstappen coming in second, which, you know, I mean, who would have thought that was going to come? You know, after everything that happened, Max starting at the back of the grid, kind of putting a token appearance in qualifying just to go out and kind of do the bare minimum he needed to do, finishing up second. But I mean, he was carving his way nicely through the race order. Wasn't easy. Didn't look like it might kind of turn out the way that they wanted, but a top five finish. Anyways, you get Carlos Sainz, where did that come from? Like at the start of the race, Carlos had a very good opening phase to the race. Danny Ricciardo in fourth, Valtteri Bottas fifth, Fernando Alonso sixth, Lando Norris. Oh, we'll talk about Lando and poor Lando, what happened to him Sunday afternoon. We'll talk about him in a minute. Kimi Raikkonen, eighth, Sergio Perez, ninth, and George Russell in 10th. George, another fantastic outing on Saturday and also pretty impressive on Sunday. Anyways, now this is where it gets interesting, is when you look at the Drivers' Championship, I love how during the race they're kind of doing the live updates here and there. Anyways, by the time it was all said and done, before I do this, are we rounding up now officially? Are we going to go with the half points? Because, you know, obsessive compulsive people like myself are just crazy about this, but whatever. To be accurate, Lewis back in leading the championship, 246.5 points, 2 points ahead of Max Verstappen with 244.5. Valtteri Bottas still hanging on to third in the Drivers' Championship, 151. Lando Norris has Valtteri well within view now. He's got 139. Sergio Perez, 120, rounds out the top five in the Drivers'. Constructors, yeah, there's a bit of daylight now growing between Mercedes and Red Bull. The Silver Arrows, 397.5 points, a little more than 30 points ahead of their Red Bull rivals, who have 364.5. McLaren now in front of Ferrari, or I guess they have been all along, 234. Ferrari, 216.5. And then Alpine rounding out the top five with 103. So, Mark, big deep breaths, sit back, relax. And I'll be honest, you know, this race I found captivating right from the word go, and everything that was happening just with that really crazy grid that we saw. You had, well, maybe we should read out the grid as well, but you know, it was interesting too, because Lewis had the opportunity to really kind of stamp his authority on this race before it even started. But then in the pandemonium, in the wet conditions, in the damp, going into the wall right at the end of Q3. You know, fortunately for Lewis, he only damaged the wing. He didn't actually damage the suspension or steering arm or something like that. But it just messed things up enough that he had one chance to really, well, I guess everybody at that point in Q3 only had one chance to nail it. But Lewis at that point was kind of chasing it a bit, and it gave Lando the opportunity. Well, I guess Lando snatched the opportunity to take pole. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think this, and I'll just share my thoughts on the race in general real quick before we start diving into the intimate details. But you're right. It was a crazy race. It was an exciting race. It was a thrilling race. And for me, I posted out a tweet a couple of days ago shortly after qualifying, and I said, dare I say this weekend is shaping up to be fun? And by that, I reflected back on the last couple of races. You know, I think we had high expectations for Zandvoort. Zandvoort was a little bit dry. It was a little bit boring. It was also cast 7 days after the disaster that was the Belgian Grand Prix, mm-hmm. which lived in the shadow of the Hungarian Grand Prix, which lived in the shadow of the British Grand Prix. So we had this sequence of races where there was a lot of negativity. There was a bit of a shadow over the competition, over the championship. This race, this weekend, it felt good. It felt fun for all of the reasons that you described. Qualifying was exciting. The outcome was fantastic. I was incredibly, incredibly excited going into Sunday morning into the Grand Prix simply because the lineup, the front row was different than we'd seen before. Lando was in a position where we knew there was a very, very good probability he could put himself into a position to win a Grand Prix. We had discussed before the season, we discussed at the midseason break, who would ultimately break through and win a Grand Prix first. Would it be Lando? Would it be Carlos? And then suddenly we're in a situation where maybe the two of them could legitimately battle for a Grand Prix win. Lewis, you're right. He'd made a couple of mistakes earlier in the weekend. Obviously, he hit the wall coming into box during the qualifying session. Ultimately, backed up Bottas. Didn't give Bottas the shot to qualify that maybe he would otherwise have had. Obviously, he made a mistake earlier in the weekend when he came into box and struck a mechanic at the front of the car. First time that's ever happened. He wasn't particularly sharp. I think for them this weekend, they had high expectations simply because, to your point, and you mentioned this earlier in the podcast, they've dominated at Russia since we returned to Russia, since we landed in Sochi in 2014. I think for Red Bull, and Tim Horaney said that best on TSN earlier today, this weekend for that team was all about damage limitation, knowing that this wasn't necessarily a track where they were going to excel at based on historic kind of expectations and historic norms. They went into this weekend with that mindset, and ultimately they stuck a new power unit in the back of Max Verstappen's car, which required them to take a fairly significant penalty. But I think they were okay with that because I don't think they expected to be ultra hyper competitive here anyways. And I think they looked at the back of the calendar. You look at Turkey and you look at some of the races remaining. They likely felt very, very confident about being successful in those places. And if they were going to take that penalty anywhere, this was probably the best place to take that penalty. And we'll probably speak to this a little bit later, but mm-hmm. obviously the weekend worked out in a way for Red Bull that they probably weren't expecting. But for Lewis, to your point, you know, ultimately starting P4 on the grid, there was always going to be an opportunity. He probably wasn't going to win this race without the circumstances that began to arise around lap 46, 47. I mean, there was a shot. He was obviously close, but I think he did everything that could have been asked for him during the Grand Prix on Sunday. But ultimately, I think what was really challenging for him was ultimately he gets up on that podium, he looks left, and guess who's standing there? It's Max Verstappen, despite the fact that he started all the way at the back of the grid. So for Lewis, I think it's a little bit of all of that performance, taking the win, and ultimately Max still finds a way to stand immediately next to me on the podium, and the separation in the Drivers' Championship is just 2 points now going into a sequence of races mm-hmm. where you have to expect Red Bull are going to be very, very fast, very, very pacey, and potentially very successful. And I say that really referring more specifically to Max's performance. But that's just a quick summary of my feeling on the weekend. I think it felt good. There weren't any negative stories that kind of cast a shadow over the weekend, as we've seen in some previous weekends. It felt fun. I feel really energized now in a way that I really haven't since prior to Silverstone. And I feel really good about the remaining seven races on the calendar.
You know, it's interesting. I think we've mentioned it a couple of times in the past couple of months that every time there's something's happened, we've said, I feel now like equilibrium's been restored to the championship. But it always felt like a little bit forced, you know, in hindsight, right? But very much for all those reasons that you just outlined, Mark, I feel very much the same way. I think that this race really did something to it. I mean, I think it's a nice way to wipe the slate clean, I guess, which is a nice analogy to make considering the rain wiped the slate clean at Sochi there on Sunday afternoon. But it was a good race because it was historic Lewis winning. You know, Max still finds a way to get onto the podium, but it wasn't easy for anyone. I mean, Max, he was flying in the first half of the race. I was surprised that he came in as early as he did. I thought that just the way that he manages his tires usually, I thought he'd be able to extend a little bit longer than he did. And then in that middle phase of the race, I think that I was surprised that he sort of... he held station a little bit, and then he seemed to be struggling because he was passed by Fernando Alonso, and it didn't look like he was going to get around Fernando. And then it looked at one point he was under pressure by, I think it was Danny Ricciardo was behind him at that point. And then I think he just kind of like settled in where he was. I was thinking, you know, it would have been great, I think, for Max and his championship aspirations, you know, to get a top five finish. I'm like, well, maybe, you know, he's going to end up about seventh, maybe eighth, the way that it's going. And then I was kind of switched my focus onto the battle at the front between Lando and Lewis. And Lewis in that final phase anyways looked like he was in the ascendancy anyways. And he was about a second, maybe 1.2, 1.3 seconds behind Lando. Every once in a while, he'd dip under that magic 1 second mark when to get the DRS. And I think they did mention it on the race broadcast that it looked like the way that it was setting up, that Lando was just doing enough, even though he was fighting him off and said after the race that it was going to be very difficult to keep Lewis behind him had the race not turned out the way it was with the torrential downpour at the end, which I think is fair. But I think that it was outlined nicely on the race broadcast. They said that it looked like Lewis was going to get one shot at Lando. Of course, that never happened legitimately. I mean, it was legitimate the way that he passed him, but I mean, we were expecting that he'd get one shot to make a move on Lando. And of course, the clouds opened and then all chaos and mayhem, all hell broke loose.
It's funny. Ultimately, I was satisfied with the weekend. I was satisfied with the Grand Prix. I'm not super excited that we ultimately saw a Lewis Max 1-2. I wanted to see something a little bit different. Mm-hmm. I wanted the drama associated with the championship to continue to perpetuate, and I wanted the suspense to continue to build as we go into these seven final Grand Prix. But it's almost like the motorsports gods were watching, and as the race began to proceed, they're like, no, we can't have a Lando win. We can't have a Carlos Sainz win. And they reached down and they helped interfere with this Grand Prix, because all of a sudden you had Lewis, who was, to your point, battling. I mean, with, I think, 3-6 laps left, and almost immediately prior to the downpour, he was about a second behind Lando. He was very, very close. I think he got within 0.2 seconds, 0.2 of a second. So he was close, and he was battling for that race win. But Max was nowhere. I mean, ultimately, if you look, lap 48, Max was P7, 3.5 seconds behind Ricciardo. And I think at that point, Max was probably supremely satisfied with that as a result. If he was to finish P7, starting from the back of the grid to collect those points, to cash in those points, I think he would have been very, very, very happy with that result. But ultimately, the motorsports gods interfered, and we ended up with our conventional Lewis Max 1-2 or Max Lewis 1-2, whatever the case might be. But again, it looks like this championship, once again, is going to go down to the wire. And for all the reasons our listeners know, that works out perfectly for me, because I will be able to report on it potentially live from Abu Dhabi in December. But it was a great weekend. Again, like I said, and this might be controversial, as much as I want Lewis to get to that century mark, as much as I want him to become a centurion for all the reasons that he deserves and for all the reasons that we'll continue to discuss now and into the future and for years to come, I just wanted to see a different result. And I felt like the weekend was setting up for that. And ultimately, we're going to get into the reason why potentially it didn't happen, but we ended up with that conventional Max Lewis 1-2.
Well, just before we head into the break here, Mark, just going back to my comments right off the top there, it's just like, if you wake up on Monday morning, you didn't get a chance to watch the race today, and you see that, you're probably like, meh, that's a hard pass, but you're really going to do yourself an injustice because it really was a fun race to watch. And I must admit that usually when I'm watching a race, I'll get up at different points, you know, maybe get a drink, or, you know, sometimes I got like some working on a couple of things around the house. I'm like, okay, I'll come back in a lap or so or whatever. And, you know, I keep the volume up so I can break into a sprint should something exciting happen. But I found myself glued to the TV the entire 53 laps. Anyways, time for a quick break. When we come back on the other side, I want to circle back and talk about what you hinted to so nicely. Was it was setting up very nicely for anything but a Lewis Hamilton, Max Verstappen 1-2 in whichever order it was. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Okay, well, welcome back to the program. You're listening to the podcast, as always, Up to Speed with Formula One with Mr. Mark Daly and Mr. Mark Hamilton. We were talking about the, talking all over the place before the before the break, because there really is so many things to cover. But like you said in the first segment, Mark, this race was really setting up for something nice, and it really looked like it was going to be. I mean, ultimately, when you have somebody like Lewis recording a milestone achievement, of course, that's a special afternoon. But, you know, I must admit, I feel very cheated and very disappointed for Lando. I feel very much the same way for him like I did for Charles Leclerc in 2018 when he had those mechanical issues in Bahrain and had that that victory snatched away from him then. But, I mean, let's kind of set this up a little bit. So this will be the first five rows from the starting grid on Sunday afternoon. You had Lando Norris on pole, Carlos Sainz in P2 in the Ferrari. You had George Russell starting third on row two next to Lewis Hamilton. You had Daniel Ricciardo, Fernando Alonso, row three. Then you had Lance Stroll, Sergio Perez, row four. And then you had Esteban Ocon and Sebastian Vettel and on row five. And of course, as we mentioned, you had Max Verstappen starting at the back of the grid. You had Charles Leclerc starting from the back of the grid. You had Nicholas Latifi starting at the back for all these reasons and guys changing power units and all these different things that, that we were expecting coming into the race, especially with Charles, especially with Max. And it was interesting, as much as Lewis didn't nail it in qualifying, he didn't nail that start, because it was interesting the way that they all got away. Carlos managed to get his car in the right position. He managed to get that tow. Lance got a good start there as well. And Lewis just found himself looking for a bit of real estate, found himself a little bit pinched, and he dropped down to what, seventh by about the third corner. Anyways, it was really interesting the way that it started, and it was apparent right away that Max was going to really claw his way up. And I was wondering at one point, you know, could Max just by pure, you know, superiority in his car power his way up into maybe a podium position? This was even before I knew they were hinting at rain all afternoon long, but it certainly seemed that way. But it was not a great start for Lewis. And I mean, that's why, as I've said already twice now, that if you just look at this result alone without watching the race, there were so many different things going on. Lewis didn't romp away to this one. Max had to work for it, and neither of them looked like they were going to score the results that they did. And then on the flip side, you got to feel so bad for Lando, because it was just one of those judgment calls, and he thought he could stay out and another lap, maybe another two laps, didn't think the rain was all that bad, and then it just was a torrential downpour. But on the flip side, Lewis extended when Mercedes wanted him to come in, and I mean, ultimately he did go in, switch on to the inters, and it made all the difference. I mean, Lando just trying to extend as long as he did, just it was the wrong call. He's obviously going to learn from it. The team will learn from that. I mean, it seems incredible to make that statement about a team like McLaren, but still, it was the wrong call that they made, and they paid for it. And it sucks if you're Lando Norris, but definitely something you're going to learn from. And his time will come. Much like Charles, his time will come as well.
Yeah, I definitely have some thoughts on this. I feel like Sunday was a bit of a race of, I shouldn't say a bit of a race, it was a Grand Prix of two races. You mm-hmm. had everything leading up to about lap 46, which in itself, to your point, was pretty exciting. You had Lando in the lead. He gave it up early. He clawed it back at lap 13. George Russell qualified exceptionally well once again, which we didn't really talk about. He holds on to P3 for a while, ultimately gives Lando and Carlos some space at the front because he creates something of a train in that midfield. So a lot of the more, I would say, legitimate podium contenders were getting backed up a little bit. But mm-hmm. what I did do, because I needed to go back and revisit this a couple of times, because again, to be fair, on the West Coast, I had to get up at 4:30 a.m. for qualifying. I fell asleep again and woke up for Q2, but I actually woke up at 4:30 a.m. Pacific time today to watch the Grand Prix, which I watched in entirety, but it was all a little bit blurry. So I went back and I recapped everything from lap 45 on, because I've got some questions for you, because I'm not quite so sympathetic to McLaren and to Lando Norris. I think most of F1 Twitter and F1 Reddit and the global motorsports community is. So I'm just going to back this up real quick. So lap 45, it's a 53 lap race. Mm-hmm. Lap 45, we hear on the radio, Peter Bonington, Lewis's engineer, that rain is coming. And I quote, "There is a risk of rain." Lap 46, Sky spans or pans to the crowd, and you start to see the crowds pulling out their umbrellas, putting on their raincoats. They're starting to get ready. And then all of a sudden we hear Lando's engineer come on the radio and say, "Hey, Lando, the umbrellas are coming up." And Lando responds, "Yes, it's spitting." Lap 46, there's now a 1 second interval between Lando and Lewis. Lap 47, Lando goes off hard, but does recover, but Hamilton is right behind him and gets to within 0.2 seconds from an interval perspective. So it's getting close. Lap 47, so six laps left, nobody has come in yet. Lap 48, Sergio Perez has now moved into third place. So if this race completes without the rain, there's no moisture, Red Bull's getting a second, or is going to get a podium anyways. Sergio's going to put in one of the best performances of his career with that team aside from the victory, although there are some unique circumstances there. Max at this point, so lap 48, when Perez moves into third place, Max is P7, 3.5 seconds behind Daniel Ricciardo. By lap 48, every car is starting to struggle. Nobody's got grip. They're going wide in corners. They're going long. It's starting to look a little bit ugly. Lance is the first car that comes in. His engineer comes on the radio, says, "You're boxing." He says nothing. He comes in as requested. He gets onto the inters. Lap 48, Peter Bonington comes onto the radio for Hamilton. Box, 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 box. Hamilton says nothing, doesn't come in, despite the fact that the mechanics are out ready for the change. And at this point, the commentators on Sky Sports are speculating, was this a bluff, or is Hamilton just persistent and wanting to stay in contention for the race win? Lap 49, Lance drifts into Seb. Terrible performance by Lance today. I'm going to be very honest. I was very, very disappointed with his performance. No damage, luckily, for both of those cars. 49, track is very, very, very slippery. So William Joseph, Lando's engineer, gets on the radio and reports to Lando, hey, track is very slippery. Lots of cars going off. To which Lando responds, shut up, into the radio very, very clearly. Lap 49, Max pits, Carlos Sainz, and Ricardo pits. Lap 49, Lando, what do you think about going on Inter, says his engineer, William Joseph. What do you think about going on to Integers, he repeats. Lando says no into the radio. At this point, seconds later, Hamilton comes into the pits. He reports, though, to his race engineer that it stopped raining. His race engineer is very clear, no, there is rain coming. There is more rain coming. Lap 50. Lando is out there battling with the Haas cars. We know he's in trouble at this point. Stroll crashes into the back of Gasly, then goes off and destroys his own race. Lando at this point has no control over the car. Lap 50, it is now pouring with rain. Lando is still on his slicks. Hamilton, within maybe 10 seconds, comes from 4 seconds back to pass Lando and take the race victory. So my question to you, knowing that we've kind of set the scene here, is who's at fault? Is this a Lando mistake? Did he do anything wrong? Is the team at fault because they weren't more forceful with their orders? Because you look at the orders for Hamilton, is Hamilton box, box, box. Initially, he was reluctant, but ultimately they come back on. Hamilton box, box, box. He comes in. I went back on the F1 TV Pro app. I listened to the race radio for multiple teams and multiple drivers. Lando seemed to be the only person who was given a real degree of input into the decision-making process. And ultimately, his race engineer served up some soft information, some soft recommendations, but there were no orders. Is Lando at fault here? Is the team at fault here? Were they not giving him information? Were they giving them wrong information? What are your thoughts? Because for me, I don't feel as bad knowing that, hey, if he'd complied with those soft recommendations originally and got onto Inters, maybe he doesn't win the race, but maybe he still finishes P2 and he takes a podium. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great recap that you had there of those last several laps. I mean, it really sets everything up nicely. First of all, I don't think that was the bluff by Lewis Hamilton and Mercedes.
I don't think so either.
I think that was a seat of the pants decision by Lewis to extend for another lap. But I mean, the thing was, like you said, I mean, Bono was on the radio. It was like box, box, box. Basically, you get in here now. And I do feel bad for Lando, but I mean, that's because I'm a bit of an unashamed Lando Norris fanboy. I want to see him do well. But I mean, 100%. It was a self-inflicted thing. And I mean, if you've said you've gone back, you've listened to the race radio from most of the other teams, and he was the only one that was given that much latitude or that much input from the pit wall, okay, that's fine. But at some point, either his race engineer or Andreas Seidel, the team principal, has to get on the horn and say to him, Lando, get your butt into the pits right now. You're going on to Inters. Okay, maybe we're going to give up the race win to Lewis, but you know what? We're still going to get a podium. So I think that there is going to be a big sit down at Woking tomorrow. I think that they're going to have to discuss this one seriously. I think that if I'm Zach Brown, I'd be like, guys, what the hell happened? Why was this so wishy-washy? Why did somebody not have the guts or the wherewithal to get on the line, get onto the radio, tell him to get in, get those inters on there, and still salvage a good result? Sure, maybe it's not first, but you know, third or second looks a heck of a lot better than P7, considering where you started, how you drove all weekend, and especially how you drove in the race. I think that this is one of these wake-up milestone moments for McLaren. They have nobody to blame but themselves.
Absolutely. Julian Palmer made a really great point, and I was listening to him earlier today. His point was, look, I don't think his response, him being Lando Norris, I don't think his response to his engineer, William Joseph, was disrespectful or arrogant when he told him to shut up. He's like, try to put yourself in Lando's position. You are leading a Grand Prix. You are 4 or 5 laps away from winning your first Formula One Grand Prix. The weather turns in an instant and you're on slicks. You're starting to lose traction in the corner. You have 7-time world champion Lewis Hamilton breathing down your neck.
Yep.
You need very, very specific tactical information from the pit wall. Hey, you're coming in now because our data shows us that there's rain coming in, or we are going to pit in two laps if these certain circumstances happen. But it was very, very wishy-washy information that they were giving him. So that first time when he told William Joseph to shut up, it was very much like, hey, it's getting slippery out there. There's lots of cars going off. From Lando's perspective, how is that going to help him? That's not direction. That's just an observation of what's happening, and he already knows that. And furthermore, later on, when cars have already started to pit and there's significant sections of the track that are wet, once again, he's like, hey, Lando, literally, this is what he said. Lando, what do you think about Inters? What do you think about Inters? Again, imagine being Lando in that moment. Like, I think a lot of our listeners, although maybe not all of them, have had that moment where you're driving in the snow, it's a little bit sketchy, you're just like focused in because you're so scared you're gonna slide through a red light or slide through a stop sign, and you're anxious and you're nervous. Like, I think that's where he was mindset. And if you're gonna give him any information, it needs to be tactical and helpful, and he wasn't getting that from the pit wall. And I think the pit wall also set him up for failure as well, because they weren't giving him the right information. Oh, and you saw that with other teams. Like, Bonington was very specific and tactical with Hamilton. There's more rain coming. Come in. There's more rain coming. So I think you're absolutely right. I think tomorrow the debrief at Woking is going to be very significant. Like, what data were the other teams looking at that we weren't seeing? Because one of the things that was speculated today as well is maybe the teams aren't all getting the same weather data, and different teams are looking at different data points, but some teams certainly know. So, well, I don't think he was being rude or arrogant. I just don't think he was getting the right data.
I don't have a problem with the driver saying that. I mean, we've heard that and seen that over the years. When they need to concentrate, they'll be like, you know, no talking, leave me alone, whatever it might be. But I mean, they're doing him a complete disservice. Like you said, they're setting him up for failure. I mean, talking in the same tone of voice is like, Lando, what do you think about going on to Inters? Very much in the same,
the
same sort of tone of voice. Hey, Lando, what do you think about going get a pizza and a cold beer after the race? You up for that, bro? You know, it's like, come on, you know. And I'd be interested, very much like you said, with the weather data, because I don't know which, I can't remember now which pit wall they had. We're kind of doing the over the shoulder onto the display there. But you could see on the radar, and you don't have to be a meteorologist to see that what was over the track, like this crosshair, looked really, really nasty and a lot of really bright colors. And I'm kind of thinking, I don't understand that, but that looks bad. You know, he needs to be knowing that. And I think that they really did the wrong thing by not giving him that information in a timely manner. Sure, that's fine. If he wants to make a call when he's out on the track, I'm saying one thing. It's like, okay, well, that's fine, but this is what we're seeing, and, you know, we got to do something about it. So the team, I think, it's, how do you want to apportion blame? At the end of the day, you probably have to give more to the pit wall, because they need to give him the information. But at the end of the day, I think somebody just needed to make the call. If it wasn't his engineer, then the team principal needs to get on the line. He needs to overrule it. You know, guys, get him in here, and we'll cut our losses. I mean, P7 just that looks really, really, really bad about that. But I don't know. If I'm Zach Brown, you know, I'm going into that one, and I'd love to see, you know, we talk about DTS all the time, right? As very much as that very first episode in season 3, when you have Lawrence Stroll in the boardroom with everyone and his sort of icy, penetrating stare. I'd love to see this one, especially if, like, Zach goes in there and, like, with one arm sweeps all the coffee off on the table or throws a mug across the room or something like that and starts screaming. You know, I think that would make for some good watching. But yeah, disappointing, self-inflicted wounds, definitely. And Lando will probably think twice about that next time, and somebody needs to sit down with his engineer as well. Is like, dude, you know, you got to be a little bit more forceful and decisive on these things and give your driver the right information. All right. Whew. I feel good there. I feel like, you know, I've bottled this up all day. It feels good to get it out in the open. But my goodness, you know, I know that Lance, you know, he hit the pair and went up the back of Pierre Gasly. He hit his teammate. Like you said, horrible day for Lance. I mean, just another black spot on what's been a pretty disappointing season. I mean, he gets a 10-second penalty on top of it. And I mean, it didn't look good when he sandwiched his teammate as well. Oh. You know, boy, you know, I don't even know where to go with that.
I think We are probably the biggest Lance Stroll fans in the world of the F1 podcast ecosystem. And it's partly because we're Canadian and we want him to be successful. He seems like a good kid. And we were both very open about how we had embraced the Aston Martin project at the beginning of the season. But you're right. And I was frustrated early on because he's in P4 early. To me, he was as much at fault for that train in the middle of the pack as George Russell was, because I felt he had the opportunity to pass George a couple of times and he just wasn't being aggressive enough, which is something I think you and I have criticized him for this year. And then just to sandwich Seb like that is just a total lack of general awareness while being on the track and not using your mirrors. That's absolutely, I shouldn't say unforgivable, but that is a blatant mistake. And ultimately, he's extremely lucky that he didn't have steering damage and suspension damage. And he's also very, very lucky that Seb didn't have damage, because we've seen contact like that between drivers in the past. And I mean, let's look back at Seb and Charles Leclerc in 2019. They came together and had very minor contact, and both of them had to retire. They could both potentially have had to retire. I mean, neither of them finished in the points, and with the 10-second penalty that our friend Lance Stroll has got, he's definitely not going to be in the points. But ultimately, it was pretty embarrassing. And then for him to plow into the back of Gasly and then go off later was just, it was a terrible, terrible race. And there was some footage that was, I don't want to say leaked, but there was some footage floating around on the web later where Seb, and you couldn't hear what was being said, but Seb was in the garage with Lawrence Stroll, and it was a very, very animated conversation. And it wasn't clear necessarily in what direction, who was being offensive and who was being defensive, but I think the frustrations have got to be starting to boil over at Aston Martin. And I got to think that Seb is one of those guys that is on the brink at this point.
Yeah, that's a great point. It makes you wonder. I mean, I know he was being really positive just earlier this week when, you know, talking about this option that he's going into his contract for 2022. But, you know, as good as that team was and as fun as they were to watch in 2020, I mean, they just have not been there all year. I mean, even before we got to Bahrain for the very first race of the year, I mean, they just could not get it together for winter testing. They had limited time on the track, and it really hasn't improved much from there. I mean, they've struggled all season. And like you say, I mean, tempers and patience must be wearing thin at this point. And it's one thing to be excited about going into a new year and into a new car and into a completely new era of Formula One. You still got 7 races to go in this season. And if this is what's happening at this point, I mean, I can imagine that that tempers are going to flare at some point. And it was just, it was a bit of a boneheaded move from Lance. I mean, you got to be pretty like fair and call it like it is. I mean, he was towards the middle of the track and then he starts to drift over at the last moment going into that right-hander, and then, you know, poor old Seb is the one that gets sandwiched. I mean, he must have known he was coming up the inside. I mean, again, I mean, we've been very critical about McLaren in the last several minutes, but I mean, I think on the flip side, you know, these drivers owe something to themselves because they're teammates, and I think as well that it wouldn't have hurt if there was a message from the pit wall from to both of those guys. It's just like, you know, be careful. But then again, maybe nobody saw that one coming. So maybe you give the guys up on the pit wall a bit of, you know, cut them a bit of slack.
Aston Martin currently 7th in the Constructors' Championship. Oof. They're 25 points behind AlphaTauri Honda. And to put this into context, between the two drivers, they only have 11 points finishes this year. And aside from Seb's miraculous second place in Baku, their best finish this year is a P5.
What were the, whereabouts were they in the championship this time last year? As Force, I was going to say Force India's racing point. I mean, they would have been what, third, fourth, fifth? Well, no, I mean they had that that points penalty as well. So, excuse me, that's changed a little bit. But yeah, it is no bueno at that team right now for sure. Anyways, let's take a quick break. We'll come back on the flip side. Still plenty more to unpack for this race, and we'll do so in just a moment. So don't go away. We'll be right back. All right. Well, welcome back to the show, Mark. Where do we go now? We've got plenty more ground to cover. Do we want to jump into the mailbag? I know we had lots of comments and lots of things. We were sending some messages back and forth. Oh, I know which one I wanted to talk about first.
Yeah, go for it.
Was from, let's pull it up, from our good friend and loyal listener, BJ Crabtree. Where did BJ's message go? I thought this was an interesting one. Actually that was from TC. Anyways, this is a good one. Maybe I'll shelve this one for BJ. Sorry, BJ. We'll come back to this one a little bit later. It's a little off topic. It's a good one I want to talk about. This one's from TC. This is the one I was thinking about. It says, hey guys, not sure if you plan to discuss this, but I watched the race twice so far. And one glaring mistake that it seems nobody's talking about is McLaren pitting a second place Danny Ricciardo before Hamilton early in the race. Why would they do that when it was clear that Lando was building on his lead with every lap? Instead, Hamilton was pumping in laps in clean air and the attack was on. Yeah, I mean, we've been very critical about what happened at the end of the race there with Lando, but I mean, just in general, I mean, their tactics and strategy was just completely out to lunch at McLaren today. I don't know. I'm at a bit of a loss for that one. I mean, this is part of the reason that you have two cars on the track, right? That you've got that second car to create a buffer if he's not able, you know, that's part of the job, is to make life difficult for the guy that's going to be racing against your teammate if you're not going to be challenging for that win the self. That was a bit of a head scratcher, I must admit, but completely, you know, I guess on brand for McLaren's train of thought and their mindset for Sunday.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's funny because I didn't really process this in the moment when I was watching the race. So I actually went back and rewatched the sequence. So to set this up, lap 15 of 53, it's Norris, Ricciardo, and Hamilton. And typically the tire strategy at Sochi so far in the history of this track has been, it's usually a one-stop race. Typically drivers will start on a medium. They'll do a short stint, 12, 15, 20, 25 laps. They'll switch over to the hard and finish off the balance of the race on the hard. By lap 15, you've got a number of drivers that have actually started dropping off and doing their tire change already. So on lap 15, it's Norris, Ricciardo, and it's Hamilton. And it stayed that way until lap 23, mm-hmm. when suddenly Ricciardo comes in. And Ricciardo comes in and he has an atrocious pit stop. Now, when Ricciardo boxed, it was a 13.7 second gap. So what TC's suggesting here is if Lando's got clean air, he's presumably going to be able to put in faster lap times than Ricciardo. So why not keep Ricciardo out as long as possible to keep backing Hamilton up so Norris can continue to build on his lead? So lap 23, they bring Ricciardo in. And if you remember, this was when Ricciardo had that really awful pit stop. So no fault of the driver, but he gets in there and the mechanic on the front left tire is having real issues. And it's not because he was having issues getting the previous tire off or the new tire on. He was struggling with the new FIA regulations, yep, around the technical directives around pit stops that are too fast. And this is something we're continuing to see. And we'll actually speak to this in a question in a couple of minutes, but yep. I don't have an answer. And it could be that, and I also listened to the radio because I wanted to see if Daniel was reporting that, hey, maybe he was in a position where he was going to lose the spot anyways, and the tire degradation was happening rapidly, or maybe there was a mechanical issue. There's a whole host of reasons, but none of them were abundantly clear to us on any of the feeds through the F1 TV Pro app. So I just have to assume it was a strategy error, or they believed he wasn't going to hold the place anyways, and they might as well get him in before he starts giving up too much time. But great question.
It was. And this parlays nicely into the next one from Taryn Clark. She says, I'm curious what your take is on what's going on with the pit stops. Are they being greatly impacted by the changes introduced in Spa, or just bad luck? Seems we've seen issues from multiple teams lately. I think it's both. I think that teams are struggling to deal with this, these new TDs that came out. They're trying to adapt to make it seems so very counterintuitive in Formula One, where the whole, I guess, the mentality and the philosophy and ethos is to make everything go faster, and then they're being, you know, forced to slow down. And I think that teams are struggling, and we're seeing errors made because of that. And I think very much, as Taryn points out, I think we've seen it across the board, not just from one team, but from several. And it might be kind of an ongoing theme as these guys get used to it over the next couple of races.
And the error that you're speaking to, yep, is back in June. So we talked about this a ton during the summer because we anticipated that this was going to be prove problematic. But mm-hmm. back on June 24th, the FIA issued a new technical directive, TD22A, which was all about safety regarding ensuring that tires or wheels were securely fastened to cars. Because the fear of the FIA was, hey, pit stops are getting too fast and there's a tremendous risk that cars are being released unsafely, meaning that they're going to take off, they're going to rejoin the track, they're going to rejoin the race, a tire is going to come off and it's going to create a crash or some form of hazard. So what happens now is if a mechanic at any of the four corners reacts too quickly to the completion of a stage of the pit stop, for instance, less than 0.15 of a second. Mm-hmm. I can never do those multiples in my head very well, but 0.15 of a second, the sensor will be invalid. So when each of the mechanics are finished the stage, so hey, you know what? I've got my pneumatic gun, I've got the wheel's mounted, I take my gun, I screw on the nut, there's a sensor, and I basically trigger the sensor and it alerts everyone else to the fact that, hey, my responsibility is done. The problem now is that if they trigger that sensor and the threshold's shorter than the FIA would appreciate, that trigger is registered as invalid, meaning that they're now actually required to redo that entire motion. And then they have to do it again. So what's happening is these mechanics are doing everything right, but they're triggering the sensor too quickly. It's registering as invalid and the car can't get released. And then all of a sudden they're sitting there, what's going on? What's going on? The mechanic realizes it's my fault because I triggered the sensor too quickly. I've now got to redo that whole motion, trigger the sensor again, hoping that it isn't under the 0.15 second threshold. So we're seeing these instances where these mechanics are doing this motion over and over again because it's registering too quickly. It's creating confusion. And that's exactly what happened with Daniel Ricciardo. So to answer this really fantastic question, yeah, it's causing a lot of havoc and it's going to take these times some time to adjust for sure.
I'll be straight up and I'm going to be blunt. I think it's crap.
Yeah, I don't like it. I think it's stupid. So stupid. It's the highest level of motorsport in the world. And you have these mechanics who train for years specifically for this one function. Mm-hmm. And you're going to handicap this function. It's crazy. It's almost like if you play golf and you hit a drive over 300 yards, well, that's too far. You're going to have to redo it. But this time that drive better be under 300 yards because that's not sporting. It's crazy. And yeah. I get the whole safety yeah. angle, but unsafe releases happen, but they're not super common. They're not super common.
You know, it'd be crazy. It's like doing like the 40-yard dash that, you know, that's such a benchmark thing in football. It's like, no, you know what? You got to slow it down by a tenth and a half of
exactly.
a second because, you know,
exactly.
you're doing the 40-yard dash too fast. You know, it just...
Yeah, the defensive line can't keep up.
Well, those guys aren't going to be able to keep up the best at times, but completely different style of athlete. But yeah, I'm not a fan of that. Okay, next one is not from BJ Crabtree. This is from BJ Miller. This is an interesting one. So BJ's comment here,
juicy. And
juicy, spicy, whatever you want to call it. What is Paul DeResta's deal with Lewis? Is there some long-lasting beef like there is with Nico? Being new to the sport, I thought it might be just me, but I see that this is actually a pretty commonly held view. It's very plain to see he absolutely loves Max and downplays everything Lewis does. Lewis could land on the moon and he'd say, yeah, but Max got out of bed today, was wondering if he did something specific to him. Great question. I have no idea. I have no more background on this one. I don't know if Lewis stole Paul's girlfriend in high school or something. Okay.
So this one is ugly.
Tell me. Okay.
And it's not something we've addressed on the air, but
okay.
Paul DeResta, Formula One driver, he drove 2011, 2012, 2013. Yeah. After 2013, he didn't get an F1 seat. He went back to DTM with Mercedes. He got that one race ride with Williams in 2017 at Hungary.
He
ultimately retired.
Yep.
So if you go back and look in the annals of Formula One history, you'll discover that Lewis Hamilton's father, Anthony Hamilton, was actually a race driver manager. He had managed Lewis Hamilton until 2010 when the two mm-hmm. of them separated. And at one point, he was also the manager for Paul DeResta. So okay. I don't want to get into the specifics here, but there was, and at least it's alleged because it was quietly settled in court, but there was at one point an instance where there was an energy drinks deal that Anthony Hamilton was working on for Paul DeResta. And it's alleged that Anthony potentially potentially underreported the value of that deal and kept the difference. And then there was a whole bunch of shady stuff relating to accounting. And then ultimately, when the court summoned Anthony to appear and they needed to provide evidence for exploration, all of his digital devices, his computers, his tablets, his phone, had all magically vanished. So it became very, very controversial at the time.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a good look for Anthony Hamilton. And Anthony Hamilton ultimately didn't get any additional clients after this. A few years later, Anthony Hamilton then took Paul DiResta to court under the pretense that he had been making unfounded allegations of fraud and incompetence about him in the media and to anyone that would listen. So there was a lot of animosity and there was a lot of friction between Paul DiResta and Anthony Hamilton. Now, I don't know that that's necessarily why Paul DiResta has always been so hypercritical of Lewis Hamilton, but even as recently as last year, there was a few incidents where Lewis had run into Paul DiResta and addressed comments that Paul DiResta had made about him in the media. Paul DiResta most recently had made accusations about the fact that Hamilton basically had inferred that Hamilton had a superior chassis and that ultimately that's why he was more successful for Bottas. And then there was a chassis swap and Hamilton got Bottas's chassis and continued to excel, at which point Lewis actually directly addressed this with him in a media scrum where Paul DiResta was doing some interviews. So there's definitely some history here. And I want to make sure that I decouple Lewis from Anthony, because there's also all sorts of backstory about the reason why Lewis is no longer managed by Anthony Hamilton. And one of the funny and curious things about that initial court case between Paul DiResta and Anthony Hamilton about the energy drinks contract is it was revealed at that time that Anthony was angry that Lewis had promised him $4 million in severance when the two of them had parted ways in 2010 that he allegedly was never paid. So I want to make sure that we isolate Anthony and Lewis in this conversation. So for sure, there's anxiety and friction between Paul DiResta and Anthony, but there's also clearly some friction and animosity between Paul DiResta and Lewis. And Paul DiResta is a media critic. He's an analyst. He's free to have his opinions. So I don't know if what's driving his negativity about Hamilton stems from his relationship with Hamilton's father or it's something else, but there's definitely something there for sure.
Yeah, there's something. You could say that. But on the flip side, you know, if Paul is looking for an energy drinks deal, I'm pretty sure Rich Energy might be able to hook him up.
Good call. Hey, by the way, it wasn't Rich Energy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's another completely different topic of rabbit hole that we could jump down. Hey, let's take another quick break. We still have a bunch of messages and emails to discuss. We'll do so in just a moment. So don't go away. We'll be right back. All right. Well, welcome back to the show. We're still talking, obviously, Formula One. We've kind of moved a little bit beyond the Russian Grand Prix. We're now talking and discussing some tweets and emails. Next one comes from Evan. Hey, quick comment. Just finishing the Thursday night pod on my way to work. Awesome show. One of the best, I'd say. Now, this is just my lazy, biased American view, but a suggestion I could make when you guys are talking about speeds and weight, obviously, it's in kilometers per hour or kilograms. I often find myself in looking that up to put it in miles per hour or pounds. Obviously, that comes natural to you and the rest of the world. So I completely understand that maybe you guys could just add an estimate of miles per hour just for the America listening, because I'm sure you guys have a few that could be better understanding if you made the quick conversion again. I completely understand. And I totally understand. I work in the land development industry. Everything that we have to do by legislation has to be in meters and millimeters, but all dimensioned lumber, all the stuff, the architectural plans is all in feet and inches. I'm doing the conversions all day long, and it's it's crazy, like this weird dual universe that we live in. But totally understand, and it is interesting too, because I think if you do look at the some of the telemetry that they put on during the race feed, I think they'll show something 320 kilometers an hour. And then, 200 miles an hour, something like that. But I completely get it, because I mean, the conversion from miles to kilometers an hour is 1.6, and it's 2.2 to go from pounds or kilos to pounds. So yeah, doing the mental arithmetic can be a little bit inconvenient at times, but totally understand.
Shout out to Evan. I thought this was a great question. Yep. And it's the timing's so funny because I was out running, I think Thursday or Friday, and this thought actually occurred to me while I was running. Because I think I saw a sign or something.
It's a premonition, Mark.
Yeah, like maybe we should be doing a little bit of that. But I have to say that as much as the world looks upon Canada as being one of those countries that's super aligned with metric standards, we do an effing terrible job of being a metric country. So I'll be totally honest. Like, if you're looking to buy a house in Canada, you talk about that house or that condo or that townhouse being in square footage. Yep. I know exactly what the square footage of every house I've ever bought is. I have no idea what the size is in square meters. Was it 1,000 square meters, 10,000 square meters, 10 square meters? No idea.
Exactly.
And likewise, with height, I know my exact height in feet and inches. If you asked me, if you put a gun to my head and said, hey, how tall are you in I don't even know, metric? No idea. 10 meters? 2 meters? I don't know.
Hey, you're 30 feet tall. Well,
totally. And likewise with weight. Like, I only know how to weigh myself in pounds. And that's not because I'm unique, but it's because in Canada, I guess there's a lot of spillover from the US and we adopt a lot of those standards. But likewise, if I'm buying fuel for my car, petrol, I only know it in liters, for instance. When I'm drinking diet soda, I only know it in milliliters and in liters. I would have no comprehension of ounces. And then you, like me, you spent a ton of time growing up in the UK, and they're a metric company, but their road signs are posted in miles per hour, which is really, really unique.
Yeah, it gets kind of confusing, this world that we live in. And it's the same thing. Like, you know, I know that, you know, I'm 6 feet, 72 inches, 1.83 meters. You know, I know this stuff because I do it and I do the conversions all day long. But yeah, you know, it's funny that, you know, if I say that, you know, I lost, you know, 1 pound, you know, that means to, you know, it that seems like an accomplishment. Like 1 kilogram is like, how much actually is it? That's actually more. That's like 2.2 pounds. You know, you should be like really excited if you're trying to get in shape, you're trying to lose weight, you lost a kilogram, because that's actually something that's quite a little bit more substantial. But it is kind of frustrating. Same thing, you know, I know my house is 3,500 square feet, but, you know, I should know this because this is literally what I do, and I should have a feel for, like, you know, what is the the metric equivalent.
Your house is 3,500 square feet?
It is, yeah,
with the finished basement. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Let's be very clear that by Vancouver standards, that is a sprawling mansion.
We're very lucky and very grateful to be able to have the space that we do here. You know, it's certainly not a luxury, and certainly not something that we see these days as,
as all of our Texas listeners are like, my garage is 3,500 square feet.
Exactly. It might be something some of us might be looking to at some point in the future, you know, when real estate finally becomes, you know, way too unaffordable here. Although I think we passed that a long time ago. Okay. I wanted to dial it back. There was a couple more here. Let's go. Okay. Javier Ramos. This was an interesting one. Hello, Mark and Mark. I have a couple of questions for the podcast, if appropriate. Again, a Gen DTS fan. And as a Latino man in Texas, a huge Checo fan above all else, do you all think some of Checo's struggle and maybe struggles of other recent Red Bull drivers are due to the fact it seems that Red Bull has designed their car specifically for Max's style and not a more general approach? My other question is, do you believe Red Bull is more focused on the driver's championship than the constructors? As a Checo fan, it seems they adopt a strategy that hurts his race for the benefit of Max. Example, pitting Checo so late in today's Russian Grand Prix, guaranteeing he would not have a chance at the podium. Love to hear your thoughts again. And new to F1, so still figuring out how teams strategize for a race. Keep up the great work. Clear eyes, full hearts, can't lose. Thanks. That's a great message, Javier. I think he's spot on. I think that he's picked up on all those points. I think that car is definitely designed, built towards Max Verstappen. I don't think that is anything unusual. I don't think that's a deviation from the norm that we've seen over the past several years. As far as the Drivers' Championship, I think that they're pretty determined to win a championship, but I think as time goes on and that gap grows between Mercedes and Red Bull, that at some point maybe they're going to throw more. I think they're throwing a ton of effort into it that way, but, you know, Checo, for one reason or another, hasn't always been able to deliver the results that they need to keep that gap to Mercedes close. I mean, it's 32, 33 points, so it's not a huge gap, but I would say at this point, I think it is significant enough that Red Bull has to be concerned about it. I mean, the thing is, they could have a good race. They could have a double points or sorry, podium finish. You know, Max and Checo being 1 and 2, maybe Bottas finishes outside of the points or has a DNF or something. So that could change. That gap could shrink or it could grow. But it's certainly something that they have to keep an eye on. But yeah, I mean, it was interesting the strategy that they had for Sergio Perez at the Russian Grand Prix. And like Javier points out, I thought it was quite eyebrow raising that they brought him in so late in the race when they did.
I'm going to do something a little bit controversial and disagree with you. And
really?
This doesn't happen very often.
Ooh, better make note of this.
I don't believe that Adrian Newey, the chief technical officer at the Red Bull Racing Formula One team based out of Milton Keynes, I don't think he would diminish his efforts to design a car that was limited to the capabilities of a single human being. So hear me out here. I think the perception in the general F1 world currently is that Max is successful because the car is built around the way he likes to drive. So a couple of thoughts on that. One, Max won the first drive he ever had in a Red Bull car. So flashback to Spain 2016. That was definitely not a car that was even remotely developed and constructed for him. And he wins that race. I think it's a couple of things. One, I think he has significantly more familiarity with that car. And let's be very honest, when Daniel Ricciardo was driving that car and that chassis, he was also very, very successful in it. Mm-hmm. I think we are now indexing as a point of reference, we're indexing Max against Pierre Gasly, who had half a season in that car. And then we compare it to Alex Albon, who had a year and a half, but was also under intense crushing pressure. And then we compare Max Verstappen against Sergio Perez, who we both love. We're big fans of Sergio Perez, but ultimately I don't think he's put in a great season and he's still himself becoming more and more comfortable with that car. So I think it's less that the car was designed for Max, but more that Max has had more runway and time to be comfortable or become comfortable with that car. And that said, it's not that they haven't listened to his feedback, because driver feedback is a big part of developing the car. But let's be very honest, Max was successful with that car from the jump. It's not like it was a two-year project where he joined the team and they spent 2 years redoing the chassis and the suspension geometry and the steering to make it more palatable to his driving style. He was very successful from the jump. So I think obviously they've listened to a tremendous amount of his input and his feedback, and they've developed the car based on that because he's an exceptionally talented driver. But I also just think he's had more time with this car. This is year 5 for him with this team. He's got immense amount of comfort, and I don't think it's fair to put him into a conversation with Gasly or Alex Albon in the circumstances around their time with that team. And again, even if you look at Alexander Albon, even when he joined the team, he was only 4 months into his F1 career. Like, that was a quick switch to make. Yeah. But Daniel Ricciardo was very successful with that team. I just think he's had more runway with that car to become more familiar with it.
You know, it'll be interesting then next year, because that advantage, I guess if you want to call it that Max Verstappen has have been in that team for the amount of time that he has, it's not really going to count as much for next year.
Awesome point. Because, that 2022 car.
For the 2022 car is going to be new for everyone. So what's the delta going to be between Checo and Max next year? What's that delta going to be between George Russell and Lewis Hamilton? I mean, this is going to be new for everyone. So, I mean, anyone that's had a longer tenure or longer stay at one of these teams that has like a newer teammate. And again, another situation that you could maybe draw parallels between Sergio Perez and Max Verstappen is Lando Norris and Danny Ricciardo. Danny obviously has struggled to come to terms with that car, despite winning at Monza a couple of weeks ago. I mean, that was a very impressive weekend for him. But I mean, before that, I mean, we've talked about it numerous times over the course of the season to date that it hasn't been quite there for Danny. It looks like he's just not 100% comfortable in that car for whatever reason. So I feel like this is applicable to a good number of drivers up and down the grid. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, that's certainly something that we have to look at. And I mean, it's going to be really interesting to see how these guys do. I mean, preseason is always a little bit different because they're always running different scenarios and testing different things. But when you get down down to the final stages towards the end of the test is about as pretty close, I think, to the race trim. So I think those last couple of sessions, last couple of days of testing might give a good indication how these guys are going to match up against each other head to head. All right, great question.
I'll just add on that real quick, because oftentimes the question that we get is, can you recommend some good Formula One books for me? Just while we're on the topic of Red Bull and Adrian Newey, his 2017 book, How to Build a Race Car, is absolutely a must-have. So if you haven't picked it up, go to Amazon, go to your favorite independent bookseller, pick up How to Build a Car by Adrian Newey. Hardcover is about $40. It is worth every penny to have on your nightstand. And I know you would agree with that recommendation.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great read. Okay, so now we're going to come back. I think we've tortured poor BJ for long enough. Anyways, BJ Crabtree says, the best race wire-to-wire to date for me. So many potential storylines throughout the race. My question is, do you think F1 can take off, truly take off in North America without more parity? Great question. And parity defined how? Just in a baseline package, performance-wise, car-to-car? Because, I mean, today was, I guess, almost artificial parity, sort of thrust upon the race order on the cars out on the racetrack because of the circumstances, because of the situation we saw on the track. I guess you could say the same again for what we saw during qualifying as well. But you know, that is the big, you know, the big push behind like the cost cap for the teams, and also a potential salary cap that we hear about. That is always, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire, and it just seems like the next logical step. I mean, that they've done, you know, what with all these things that they've, you know, cost cutting measures and things, the new Concord Agreement that was all put in place in the early days of the pandemic. So that seems like a logical thing. But that's why, you know, going into 22 makes it so fascinating, because it's going to be the whole new era. You know, the cost cap is here, it's in force. We've already heard teams moaning about it this year because of cars that have been destroyed in accidents and all these different things, right? And one way or another, it really raises a lot of questions. You know, like, will there be parity just because there's less headroom when it comes to spending money in R&D? Is it going to hurt teams because, you know, they can't afford to rebuild cars and, you know, build, you know, more parts late in the season? There's different ways that you can try and create parity. And I wonder, you know, as this sort of sliding scale and the cost cap comes down over the next couple of years, how this is going to, you know, really manifest itself. But I think the thing is that when it comes to the amount of money that you have, like, there will still be a lot of room and opportunity in Formula One to innovate and really be creative within the rules and the constraints that you have. So the big teams, the teams with all the brain power and all that sort of stuff, like Mercedes and Ferrari, they will always have that advantage, because they will just be, you know, just by nature of who they are, I think we'll be able to cherry pick the best minds into their teams to develop and build these cars.
My good friend Bert Pinkerton is going to get a chuckle out of this, but I think that's a really good point. I think that despite the presence of a cost cap, I think there will always be potential periods of domination by a specific team. And a lot of that could just be you've got a really great driver in that car, or you've got really great personnel and designers and expertise at an executive level to run that organization. I think to answer the question, and I think this is a good question, team sports in the US have flourished despite periods of domination. If you look at the NFL, That league has been dominated by certain teams over certain periods of time. And no question, the New England Patriots were a big part of that league for the better part of the last 18 or 19 years.
It's at least been a long time, right?
Yeah, at least until Tom Brady departed for Tampa Bay. And never did that seem to impact the popularity of that league. If there's anything that could be considered a slam dunk in terms of TV ratings and ad revenue in the US, it's the NFL. And there's been some really significant dynasties in that league. And Major League Baseball, when it was very much at its peak late 90s during the steroid era, it was absolutely dominated by one very specific team in the New York Yankees. And yep. the leagues will adjust and they'll shift and they'll try to create parity by introducing salary caps and by doing things like expanding the playoffs and by changing the rules to encourage more offense or to encourage less offense. It's something that leagues will always have to do. I think Formula One can definitely be popular in the US with some degree of missing parity, but I think what will really trigger the growth of Formula One in the US is when we eventually get a US driver or a meaningful US team that fans can really rally behind. So when we go to COTA or we go to Miami or we go to Indianapolis or we go to Vegas or we go to maybe to Denver, you'll see that ocean of fans rocking the red, white, and the blue because there's an American-born talent on the grid and he or she is somebody that they can rally behind. So to answer the question, I think that despite the lack of parity, it can be very, very successful. There have been long stretches in NASCAR as well where it's been dominated by one specific driver like Jimmy Johnson, and NASCAR has been exceptionally popular. And again, from a relative perspective, the last 6 or 7 years has been different, but historically there has been real periods of dominance in that sport, and it's never seemed to impact the popularity of the sport.
Yeah, I think it will take off. I think that it's really getting it embedded and really growing it at the grassroots level and really building on the popularity and the interest that has really exploded over the past year or so. Our good friend Vincenzo Landino, who's watching on the live stream, he says, Lando Hamilton Sainz podium would have been solid. Parity is needed, but there are better ways to do it. It's not an easy and quick fix. And certainly, I don't think there's any quick answers, but I think they've set a lot of, I think the financial aspect of it is important. I think not, you know, just also from a fiscal responsibility and just, you know, setting a good solid groundwork for Formula One is important. I think you want to keep the base of teams stable so you don't have teams coming and going, that teams that are there can focus on staying there in the long term. And if you're there in the long term, then you can focus, you can build rather than struggling and worrying whether or not you're going to be there from 1 year to the next. And it seems that we're seeing some good signs there, despite we may have lost a couple of teams because of the uncertainty that the pandemic caused. I mean, Haas is obviously a big question mark as what's going on with them. But I mean, the other ones were on the cusp, if you want to call it that, seem to have stabilized. And we've seen some encouraging signs from Williams, which is a team I was quite concerned about. And if you kind of believe some of the rumors, was one of the teams that was teetering pretty close to the edge of the abyss about a year and a bit ago. So great question. All right. Well, got one more here before we turn off the lights and call it a night here. This is from the email at scuderyf1pod@gmail.com. This is from Reiko Montoya. Hi, Mark and Mark. I'm a new fan of Formula One, and yes, it's because of DTS. I love it. I can't get enough of it. I feel like a sponge, and I'm taking it all in. Where has F1 been all my life? I love the podcast. I listen to you guys religiously. I love the content that you guys are putting out. It was because of you guys that my husband and I are going to our first Grand Prix in Austin. So this is where I pause, and I say I'm jelly as well. I'm going to censor the rest of it. I'm just really jealous. Anyways, to pick up Rachel's email, I was listening to the pod at the beginning of the season. You guys were so pumped up. It made me so pumped up. And I told my husband, let's go. We're also attending IndyCar in Long Beach this Sunday. I wanted to check it out. I think of Indy as the amuse-bouche for the Austin F1 race. So I wanted to ask, do you guys have any tips for attending the Grand Prix? What time should I get there? I don't want to miss anything. Do I need any earplugs? Any tips are appreciated. So that's first point, or first couple. Second one is for you specifically, Mr. H. And he, Enrico says, I wanted to ask Mark if he is planning on sharing any videos or pictures on social media of his trip to Abu Dhabi at the end of the year. I know you're planning on attending, right? I don't know if my family would ever be able to attend a race that far. I live in SoCal, and I would love to see Pick's video of that amazing trip. Hope this wasn't too long. Thanks for the amazing podcast. Keep up the great work. All right. So the first question from Reiko is, tips for attending the Grand Prix. What time should I get there? Do I not want to miss anything? Earplugs, anything like that? first thing you want to do is make sure that you have the full schedule. You want to check out any of the support races that are going to be going on. Most of the time, you want to be there for if the pit lane is open, you know, if you're able to go in there, see what your tickets give you guys access to. Check out all the events that are on the schedule and find out, you know, what you want to take in. I mean, on the races that I've been into, has been always a bit of a combination visit to wherever that race was. So, you know, there's always plenty to do. I mean, you know, when I've been to Spain in the past, Barcelona is a wonderful, beautiful city. So there's as many things to do away from the track as there is the track. So, you know, sometimes, you know, time is limited. So make sure you, you know, take all those things. And especially the support races are pretty cool. You know, there's plenty that are usually on the card. So check those out. Earplugs, probably a good idea. Everybody's a little bit sensitive. They're not quite as loud as they used to be in the old normally aspirated days, but certainly, you know, those are one of those things that, you know, you'd rather have them in your pocket and not use them rather than not have them at all or leave them in the hotel and be, you know, sitting there with, you know, your eardrums, you know, ready to split wide open. So again, there's a lot of things, you know, just, you know, make sure you're just fully prepared. I know you've got a lot of thoughts. So why don't you take it from there, Mark?
So I think it's a great question. And thank you for reaching out, because this is somebody that's been a big supporter of our program and drops into our spaces chat and just silently observes from the sidelines, despite the fact that I'm always inviting you to participate. But I get that a lot of people join.
You're looking at me when you said that. I participated last week.
Not you. But again, thank you for this really, really great question. So a couple of things. One, congratulations on being able to go to the conclusion of the IndyCar calendar today at Long Beach. I saw your social media posts earlier, and I think you've already picked up on the fact that the cars are loud. So to Daly's point earlier, I think earplugs are a no question requirement. I think that without them, you can survive, but I would promise you that you'll get you'll get fatigued far more quickly than you would without them. So buy them in advance, find something that's comfortable. You can often buy them at the track, but they can be very, very expensive. So my recommendation is
sometimes
you buy
sometimes they hand them out for free as well, but that's not a given.
Exactly. And I would just buy the cheap disposable ones. If you lose them, it's not a big deal. Pack a couple of extra pairs. Learn how to use them in advance, because I think sometimes people struggle to figure out how to use disposable foam earplugs.
But you can go down to like your local hardware store and buy them. They come like a little package for a couple. You go down to Home Depot or something like that. They're dirt cheap.
Totally. Walmart. Yeah. And I think my recommendations for COTA specifically is when COTA first opened, they had a blanket you can't bring in anything policy. And I think a lot of people were really upset about that. And they've relaxed that a little bit. You still can't bring in food or drink, which is common in a lot of the European tracks where people are used to bringing in their own alcohol and their own food and their own coolers. Mm-hmm. You can bring collapsible chairs. So if you're not going to be sitting in a grandstand, definitely bring collapsible chairs for a little bit of comfort. I would recommend you figure out parking in advance. Parking, getting in and getting out can be a bit of a nightmare. This event is going to be jammed. It sold out almost immediately. And I was talking to somebody earlier, and I don't want to share the specific person online because people might be able to figure out where their significant other works. But this person was saying that their significant other's employer typically gives out passes to COTA every single year. And historically, they haven't been able to give them away. This year, they were snapped up instantly, which kind of speaks to the demand. So figure out parking in advance, get there early, and also expect that after the event, you're probably going to be in the parking lot for a while. So if you need to go to the washroom before you get to your car. I would get there as early as possible every single day. For me, I get there at the crack of dawn. As soon as the gates open, I'm in there. Couple of recommendations, use Google Earth, get to know the layout of the track, figure out where the concession stands are, learn where the washrooms are. On day one, especially if you're going to be getting in via general admission, you won't be in the grandstands, do a complete walk of the track, the entire circumference of the track. It'll take about 2 hours once you get through security, but you'll learn the lay of the land, you'll become familiar with the track layout, you'll figure out where the best seats are, where the best vantage points are. I think that's always really, really fun, but I think you kind of nailed it with the earplugs as well. And then typically, some of the bigger tracks do a Sunday concert, and I know COTA is no exception, so they'll have a Sunday event as well. That's a good one to go to. And then some tracks as well will make drivers available very, very briefly for signing autographs. But typically it's positioned such a way that they'll bring the drivers out, they'll sit them behind a table on a stage, and you need to be standing in line to get there. At an event like COTA, there could potentially be thousands of people in line ahead of you. So if you do want to get signatures at one of these driver accessibility events, just know that you are probably going to have to sacrifice an entire day to line up just for a single team. So it's a long shot, but it might be worth doing based on what your preferences are. But just have a lot of fun. Take sunscreen, especially if it's going to be sunny. Pack a light jacket as well for the morning, for the evening, because it can get a little bit cool. We've seen moisture at COTA in the past, So it's not impossible. But ultimately, I think you probably learned a lot from having attended Long Beach today. Just know that you probably won't be able to get as close to the cars as you can at a street course like Indy, where you can just walk up to the barrier and you can be inches or feet away from the cars. At a track like COTA, you won't be able to get that close because they have such significant runoff distances and things like that. But have fun. I know you and I are both very, very jealous. I know at least 30 or 40 of our regular listeners are going. So I'm both excited and very, very jealous. Angrily jealous.
Yeah, me too. That goes for me as well. One other thing I'd like to add as well, and this will vary from venue to venue, from track to track. One other thing you might want to check depending on where you're staying, you know, if you've got a rental car, whether you're driving your own car. But sometimes in the cities that, you know, that near closest to the track, some bus company, some tour company may offer a shuttle service to and from the track. You know, I've done that before, and it can be super convenient, but it's one of these things. It's not kind of like a hop on, hop off. It's kind of like you book your tickets in advance. So I don't have any specific tips for anything like that for COTA, other than that's something you might just want to jump online and search up. But now part two of Reiko's question is, what are your plans specifically for Abu Dhabi? You're going to be there. You're making like an extended thing out of it. You're not just going in for a week or 2 weeks. You're going to be in the Middle East for quite some time, but you know, you're going to the race. What are your plans? You know, you got to make it good. You know, there's expectations.
I know. So I'm very, very excited. I will also share that since we're going to be in the region for the entire winter, I'm also looking at potentially trying to find a way to get to Jeddah. So that's not a guarantee, but my thought is it's a 2-hour flight. I'm in the region. If I can make it work, even if I can just pop in for the Grand Prix on the Sunday and pop out again, maybe it would be worth it. I'm also having conversations with the race organizers about potentially attending. So maybe that happens, maybe it doesn't, but obviously Yas will. So I've been before. I love it. It's a very, very different experience than a conventional Formula One event. So I like to compare a traditional Formula One event like COTA or Montreal or some of the events in Western Europe or Japan or Hungary. To me, they're kind of like a cross between a music festival and a carnival. And it's just this big mishmash of people. You pour in, everyone's eating, everybody's drinking, there's barbecue, there's food, there's music. It's just really an exciting atmosphere. Yas is very different in a good way. It's more like a tailored arena event. So it's crystal clean. Each section of the track is compartmentalized. So typically when you go to a Grand Prix, you go through the gate and you can walk the entire circumference of the track. You can check out all the general admission perspectives. You can go to all the different food outlets. You can go to all the different merchandising outlets. Yas is a little bit different because it compartmentalizes a little bit. So if you have tickets to one specific section, typically you are required to spend your time in that section. And some of the security gates can be a little bit more lenient to let you in the days before the Grand Prix. But it is a very, very different event. It's very polished. The grandstands are very comfortable. The washrooms are permanent washrooms, which is something you wouldn't typically see at a Grand Prix. So it's a different experience. It's also an event that takes place at dusk going into the evening. So you get there during the day, the race starts at dusk, and then it actually finishes at night. So it's a unique experience. And then because it's the last race of the season, they typically have a very, very big fireworks festival. And what I missed last time, and I've been kicking myself forever, is we were sitting in the main grandstand and we wanted to get down on the track when the race was finished because we wanted to watch the podium celebration in person, which we were able to do. And if you actually go back and look at the footage, you can see us on the track. But what we missed was we actually had to leave the grandstands to go and line up for the podium celebration before the race was finished. So we actually missed Nico's celebration. So he came back, how he was doing 360s, he was doing donuts, he jumped out of the car. We missed all of that. We were 50 feet away. We missed it all. So this year we won't make that mistake, but absolutely I will be posting as much social media as I can. So pictures and whatever's allowable. I'll probably send some voice notes from the track. We got to figure out how we'll do the podcast that night because there's typically a very, very big concert afterwards. So when we were there in 2016, they shuttled everyone after the race was done to a concert venue nearby and Rihanna did a concert, which was really, really cool to see because we're big Rihanna fans, but it's a different experience. It's not better. It's not worse. It's just a different type of Formula One experience. It's very, very polished, very, very catered, but still very, very exciting nonetheless. So I will absolutely be pumping the social media feed full of content on those days.
You know, a couple of things. I mean, I'm jealous that you're going in just in general, but I'm also doubly jealous because you're going to come back in early in the new year looking so tanned compared to the rest of us that are going to be stuck at home in the doom and the gloom and the perpetual rain. But anyways, that's awesome. And I expect you to be nothing less than completely hoarse after that race when we somehow managed to connect to do the show, especially if, you know, there's a concert afterwards. But there was a couple of things I just want to mention as well. Also, when it comes to the podium ceremonies, I'm, you know, notoriously lazy about those sorts of things at races. I'm always like, meh, I can't be bothered to run all the way up to start finish to go to the podium. I always just tend to, watch it on the big screen or watch it later on. So shame on me. And then one other thing I just wanted to address just in the first part, just about like attending at the circuit, you made a touch on really briefly was the whole merchandising thing. So if you want to go and get, you're looking to get some Mercedes merch or some Ferrari merch or whatever, if you figure you're going to spend $250, if that's whatever you're bringing, you know, probably not a bad idea to double it, you know, just to be on the safe side. So make sure if you're going to do that, just be prepared for some, you know, some super sticker shock when you get to the circuit. So there's
and,
that
and
as
at
well.
Least at Coda, you're going to be familiar with the currency. I've been at tracks in the past where I didn't understand the currency. I'm like, I'm going to buy this Lewis Hamilton t-shirt. And then I look at my Visa statement a month later, like that shirt was $170. So yeah, you're better off buying it. It's fun to browse, but yeah, you're absolutely right. It's more economical to buy in advance and take it with you.
Yeah, you know, I've had that same experience. You buy something at the track, you're like, hey, that didn't seem so bad, that when that Visa statement comes in at the end of the month after you get home, you're just like, ooh, I better ask the boss and see if there's any overtime on offer. I got to bring this balance down a little bit. That turned out to be a little bit more than we thought. Anyways, great.
I just want to add one more real quick thing as well. We had very much absolutely plan to be at COTA this year. To be very, very honest with everyone, for us in Canada, it's not so cut and dry to get to the US right now, mm-hmm. or to get back in terms of quarantine expectations and all of those different logistical pieces. So I think next year we're very much committed to being at COTA and or Canada because we want to meet everybody. We had planned this year to do an event on the Saturday night. We planned to do a dinner at a barbecue restaurant in Austin downtown. Ultimately, it just proved to be extremely challenging logistically for us. And we didn't want to lay out the capital for car rentals and hotel and tickets if ultimately it was not going to be possible for us. So we decided that, hey, let's reduce the stress and revisit this next year. So we had absolutely wanted to go. We know there's some people that are disappointed. We're very disappointed, but rest assured that we'll definitely be at one of the North American Grand Prix next year.
And we live in a place where we'll fly down over the border to go to Costco and Bellingham to get like milk and butter or whatever, just to, and just, it's like a simple thing, you know, and, or it used to be at any rate. So hopefully at this time next year that the world is a little bit simpler and more convenient like it once used to be. And we don't have to worry about things like vax passports and quarantines and all these logistical nightmares and things like that. And we're in a much better place 12 months from now. Anyways, Mark, that's all I got for tonight. You know, this was an extremely enjoyable race this weekend. It was an eventful race for all of the right reasons. And it was good fun to watch. We now get, a weekend off before we go to Istanbul Park in Turkey. I guess it's on the 8th, 9th, and 10th of October. So it's close, not quite close enough. You know, like as I complained about, I think it was last week, that you get used to these double and triple headers. And now as the calendar has some empty weekends in between, it makes it, I wouldn't say less fun, but certainly the empty weekends, I find myself having to fill it up. But it's football season. That's that time gap is easily replaced. Anyways, I think that's about all that we have for tonight. Thank you all very much for listening. Thank you all very much for watching. If you want to get in touch, by all means, do so. You can follow us on Twitter at ScooteryF1Pod, or you can email us at ScooteryF1Pod@gmail.com. And to help us grow the show, by all means, please leave a rating review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you download, listen to your podcast. We would be very, very grateful for that. And in the theme of Texas, and to build on Javier's email, I'll sign off with the following: clear eyes, full hearts, hand loose. I'm a big fan of Friday Night Lights. I should know this. Anyways, bye for now.